5 hours. Besides, the Illuminati don't need their path of illumination anymore. Their secret lair is probably long gone anyway. They live in the modern world. They meet in bank boardrooms, eating clubs, private golf courses. Tonight they want to make their secrets public. This is their moment, their grand unveiling. Langdon feared the Illuminati unveiling would have a special symmetry to it that he had not yet mentioned. The four brands. The killer is sworn each cardinal would be branded with a different symbol. Proof the ancient legends are true, the killer had said. The legend of the four ambigrammatic brands was as old as the Illuminati itself. Earth, air, fire, water. Four words crafted in perfect symmetry. Just like the word Illuminati. Each cardinal was to be branded with one of the ancient elements of science. The rumor that the four brands were in English rather than Italian remained a point of debate among historians. English seemed a random deviation from their natural tongue, and the Illuminati did nothing randomly. Langdon turned up the brick pathway before the archive building. Ghastly images thrashed in his mind. The overall Illuminati plot was starting to reveal its patient grandeur. The Brotherhood had vowed to stay silent as long as it took, amassing enough influence and power that they could resurface without fear, make their stand, fight their cause in broad daylight. The Illuminati were no longer about hiding. They were about flaunting their power, confirming the conspiratorial myths as fact. Tonight was a global publicity stunt. Vittoria said, "Here comes our escort." Langdon looked up to see a Swiss guard hurrying across an adjacent lawn toward the front door. When the guard saw them, he stopped in his tracks. He stared at them, as though he thought he was hallucinating. Without a word, he turned away and pulled out his walkie-talkie. Apparently incredulous at what he was being asked to do, the guard spoke urgently to the person on the other end. The angry bark coming back was indecipherable to Langdon, but its message was clear. The guard slumped, put away the walkie-talkie, and turned to them with a look of discontent. Not a word was spoken as the guard guided them into the building. They passed through four steel doors, two passkey entries, down a long stairwell, and into a foyer with two combination keypads. Passing through a high-tech series of electronic gates, they arrived at the end of a long hallway outside a set of wide oak double doors. The guard stopped, looked them over again, and, mumbling under his breath, walked to a metal box on the wall. He unlocked it, reached inside, and pressed a code. The doors before them buzzed, and the deadbolt fell open. The guard turned, speaking to them for the first time. "The archives are beyond that door. I have been instructed to escort you this far and return for briefing on another matter." "You're leaving?" Vittoria demanded. "Swiss guards are not cleared for access to the secret archives. You are here only because my commander received a direct order from the Camerlengo."
"But how do we get out?"
"Monodirectional security. You will have no difficulties." That being the entirety of the conversation, the guard spun on his heel and marched off down the hall. Vittoria made some comment, but Langdon didn't hear. His mind was fixed on the double doors before him, wondering what mysteries lay beyond. Chapter 47. Although he knew time was short, Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca walked slowly. He needed the time alone to gather his thoughts before facing opening prayer. So much was happening. As he moved in dim solitude down the northern wing, the challenge of the past 15 days weighed heavy in his bones. He had followed his holy duties to the letter. As was Vatican tradition, following the Pope's death, the Camerlengo had personally confirmed expiration by placing his fingers on the Pope's carotid artery, listening for breath, and then calling the Pope's name 3 times. By law, there was no autopsy. Then he had sealed the Pope's bedroom, destroyed the papal fisherman's ring, shattered the die used to make lead seals, and arranged for the funeral. That done, he began preparations for the conclave. "Conclave," he thought, the final hurdle. It was one of the oldest traditions in Christendom. Nowadays, because the outcome of conclave was usually known before it began, the process was criticized as obsolete, more of a burlesque than an election. The Camerlengo knew, however, this was only a lack of understanding. Conclave was not an election. It was an ancient, mystic transference of power. The tradition was timeless. The secrecy, the folded slips of paper, the burning of the ballots, the mixing of ancient chemicals, the smoke signals. As the Camerlengo approached through the loggias of Gregory XIII, he wondered if Cardinal Mortati was in a panic yet. Certainly Mortati had noticed the preferiti were missing. Without them, the voting would go on all night. Mortati's appointment as the great elector, the Camerlengo assured himself, was a good one. The man was a free thinker and could speak his mind. The conclave would need a leader tonight more than ever. As the Camerlengo arrived at the top of the royal staircase, he felt as though he were standing on the precipice of his life. Even from up here, he could hear the rumble of activity in the Sistine Chapel below, the uneasy chatter of 165 cardinals. 161 cardinals, he corrected. For an instant, the Camerlengo was falling, plummeting toward hell, people screaming, flames engulfing him, stones and blood raining from the sky. And then silence. When the child awoke, he was in heaven. Everything around him was white. The light was blinding and pure. Although some would say a 10-year-old could not possibly understand heaven, the young Carlo Ventresca understood heaven very well. He was in heaven right now. Where else could he be? Even in his short decade on earth, Carlo had felt the majesty of God. The thundering pipe organs, the towering domes, the voices raised in song, the stained glass, shimmering bronze and gold. Carlo's mother, Maria, brought him to Mass every day. The church was Carlo's home. "Why do we come to Mass every single day?" Carlo asked. Not that he minded at all. "Because I promised God I would," she replied. "And a promise to God is the most important promise of all. Never break a promise to God." Carlo promised her he would never break a promise to God. He loved his mother more than anything in the world. She was his holy angel. Sometimes he called her Maria Benedetta, the Blessed Mary, although she did not like that at all. He knelt with her as she prayed, smelling the sweet scent of her flesh and listening to the murmur of her voice as she counted the rosary. "Hail Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death." "Where is my father?" Carlo asked, already knowing his father had died before he was born. "God is your father now," she would always reply. "You are a child of the church." Carlo loved that. "Whenever you feel frightened," she said, "remember that God is your father now. He will watch over you and protect you forever. God has big plans for you, Carlo." The boy knew she was right. He could already feel God in his blood. Blood. Blood raining from the sky. Silence. Then heaven. His heaven, Carlo learned as the blinding lights were turned off, was actually the intensive care unit in Santa Clara Hospital, outside of Palermo. Carlo had been the sole survivor of a terrorist bombing that had collapsed a chapel where he and his mother had been attending Mass while on vacation. 37 people had died, including Carlo's mother. The papers called Carlo's survival the miracle of St. Francis. Carlo had, for some unknown reason, only moments before the blast, left his mother's side and ventured into a protected alcove to ponder a tapestry depicting the story of St. Francis. "God called me there," he decided. "He wanted to save me." Carlo was delirious with pain. He could still see his mother kneeling at the pew, blowing on a kiss, and then, with a concussive roar, her sweet-smelling flesh was torn apart. He could still taste man's evil. Blood showered down. His mother's blood. The Blessed Maria. God will watch over you and protect you forever, his mother had told him. But where was God now? Then, like a worldly manifestation of his mother's truth, a clergyman had come to the hospital. He was not any clergyman. He was a bishop. He prayed over Carlo, the miracle of St. Francis. When Carlo recovered, the bishop arranged for him to live in a small monastery attached to the cathedral over which the bishop presided. Carlo lived and tutored with the monks. He even became an altar boy for his new protector. The bishop suggested Carlo enter public school, but Carlo refused. He could not have been more happy with his new home. He now truly lived in the house of God. Every night, Carlo prayed for his mother. God saved me for a reason, he thought. What is the reason? When Carlo turned 16, he was obliged by Italian law to serve 2 years of reserve military training. The bishop told Carlo that if he entered seminary, he would be exempt from this duty. Carlo told the priest that he planned to enter seminary, but that first he needed to understand evil. The bishop didn't understand. Carlo told him that if he was going to spend his life in the church fighting evil, first he had to understand it. He couldn't think of any better place to understand evil than in the army. The army used guns and bombs. A bomb killed my blessed mother. The bishop tried to dissuade him, but Carlo's mind was made up. Be careful, my son, the bishop had said, and remember, the church awaits you when you return. Carlo's 2 years of military service had been dreadful. Carlo's youth had been one of silence and reflection. But in the army, there was no quiet for reflection. Endless noise, huge machines everywhere, not a moment of peace. Although the soldiers went to mass once a week at the barracks, Carlo did not sense God's presence in any of his fellow soldiers. Their minds were too filled with chaos to see God. Carlo hated his new life and wanted to go home, but he was determined to stick it out. He had yet to understand evil. He refused to fire a gun, so the military taught him how to fly a medical helicopter. Carlo hated the noise and the smell, but at least it let him fly up in the sky and be closer to his mother in heaven. When he was informed his pilot's training included learning how to parachute, Carlo was terrified. Still, he had no choice. God will protect me, he told himself. Carlo's first parachute jump was the most exhilarating physical experience of his life. It was like flying with God. Carlo could not get enough. The silence, the floating, seeing his mother's face in the billowing white clouds as he soared to earth. God has plans for you, Carlo. When he returned from the military, Carlo entered the seminary. That had been 23 years ago. Now, as Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca descended the royal staircase, he tried to comprehend the chain of events that had delivered him to this extraordinary crossroads. Abandon all fear, he told himself, and give this night over to God. He could see the great bronze door of the Sistine Chapel now, dutifully protected by 4 Swiss guards. The guards unbolted the door and pulled it open. Inside, every head turned. The Camerlengo gazed out at the black robes and red sashes before him. He understood what God's plans for him were. The fate of the church had been placed in his hands. The Camerlengo crossed himself and stepped over the threshold. Chapter 48. BBC journalist Gunther Glick sat sweating in the BBC network van parked on the eastern edge of St. Peter's Square and cursed his assignment editor. Although Glick's first monthly review had come back filled with superlatives, resourceful, sharp, dependable, here he was in Vatican City on Pope Watch. He reminded himself that reporting for the BBC carried a hell of a lot more credibility than fabricating fodder for the British Tatler. But still, this was not his idea of reporting. Glick's assignment was simple, insultingly simple. He was to sit here waiting for a bunch of old farts to elect their next chief old fart. Then he was to step outside and record a 15-second live spot with the Vatican as a backdrop. Brilliant. Glick couldn't believe the BBC still sent reporters into the field to cover this schlock. You don't see the American networks here tonight. Hell no. That was because the big boys did it right. They watched CNN, synopsized it, and then filmed their live report in front of a blue screen, superimposing stock video for a realistic backdrop. MSNBC even used in-studio wind and rain machines to give that on-the-scene authenticity. Viewers didn't want truth anymore. They wanted entertainment. Glick gazed out through the windshield and felt more and more depressed by the minute. The imperial mountain of Vatican City rose before him as a dismal reminder of what men could accomplish when they put their minds to it. "What have I accomplished in my life?" he wondered aloud. "Nothing." "So, give up," a woman's voice said from behind him. Glick jumped. He had almost forgotten he wasn't alone. He turned to the back seat where his camera woman, Shanita Macri, sat silently polishing her glasses. She was always polishing her glasses. Shanita was black, although she preferred African-American. A little heavy and smart as hell. She wouldn't let you forget it, either. She was an odd bird, but Glick liked her. And Glick could sure as hell use the company. "What's the problem, Gunth?" Shanita asked. "What are we doing here?" She kept polishing. "Witnessing an exciting event? Old man locked in the dark is exciting. You do know you're going to hell, don't you?"
"Already there."
"Talk to me." She sounded like his mother. "I just feel like I want to leave my mark." "You wrote for the British Tatler."
"Yeah, but nothing with any resonance."
"Oh, come on. I heard you did a groundbreaking article on the Queen's secret sex life with aliens."
"Thanks."
"Hey, things are looking up. Tonight you make your first 15 seconds of TV history." Glick groaned. He could hear the news anchor already. "Thanks, Gunther. Great report." Then the anchor would roll his eyes and move on to the weather. "I should have tried for an anchor spot." Macri laughed. "With no experience? And that beard? Forget it." Glick ran his hands through the reddish gob of hair on his chin. "I think it makes me look clever." The van's cell phone rang, mercifully interrupting yet another of Glick's failures. "Maybe that's editorial," he said, suddenly hopeful. "You think they want a live update?"
"On this story?"
Macri laughed. "You keep dreaming." Glick answered the phone in his best anchorman voice.
"Gunther Glick, BBC. Live in Vatican City."
The man on the line had a thick Arabic accent.
"Listen carefully," he said. "I am about to change your life."
Chapter 49 Langdon and Vittoria stood alone now outside the double doors that led to the inner sanctum of the secret archives. The decor in the colonnade was an incongruous mix of wall-to-wall carpets over marble floors, and wireless security cameras gazing down from beside carved cherubs in the ceiling. Langdon dubbed it Sterile Renaissance. Beside the arched ingress hung a small bronze plaque. Archivio Vaticano, Curatore Padre Jacqui Tommaso. Father Jacqui Tommaso. Langdon recognized the curator's name from the rejection letters at home in his desk. "Dear Mr. Langdon, it is with regret that I am writing to deny..." Regret. Bullshit. Since Jacqui Tommaso's reign had begun, Langdon had never met a single non-Catholic American scholar who had been given access to the secret Vatican archives.
"Il Guardiano," historians called him.
Jacqui Tommaso was the toughest librarian on earth. As Langdon pushed the doors open and stepped through the vaulted portal into the inner sanctum, He half expected to see Father Jacques in full military fatigues and helmet, standing guard with a bazooka. The space, however, was deserted. Silence. Soft lighting. Archivio Vaticano. One of his life dreams. As Langdon's eyes took in the sacred chamber, his first reaction was one of embarrassment. He realized what a callow romantic he was. The images he had held for so many years of this room could not have been more inaccurate. He had imagined dusty bookshelves piled high with tattered volumes, priests cataloging by the light of candles and stained glass windows, monks poring over scrolls. Not even close. At first glance, the room appeared to be a darkened airline hangar in which someone had built a dozen freestanding racquetball courts. Langdon knew, of course, what the glass-walled enclosures were. He wasn't surprised to see them. Humidity and heat eroded ancient vellums and parchments, and proper preservation required hermetic vaults like these, airtight cubicles that kept out humidity and natural acids in the air. Langdon had been inside hermetic vaults many times, but it was always an unsettling experience. Something about entering an airtight container where the oxygen was regulated by a reference librarian. The vaults were dark, ghostly even, faintly outlined by tiny dome lights at the end of each stack. In the blackness of each cell, Langdon sensed the phantom giants, row upon row of towering stacks laden with history. This was one hell of a collection. Vittoria also seemed dazzled. She stood beside him, staring mutely at the giant transparent cubes. Time was short, and Langdon wasted none of it scanning the dimly lit room for a book catalog, a bound encyclopedia that cataloged the library's collection. All he saw was the glow of a handful of computer terminals dotting the room. "Looks like they've got a biblion. Their index is computerized." Vittoria looked hopeful. "That should speed things up." Langdon wished he shared her enthusiasm, but he sensed this was bad news. He walked to a terminal and began typing. His fears were instantly confirmed. The old-fashioned method would have been better. "Why?" He stepped back from the monitor. "Because real books don't have password protection. I don't suppose physicists are natural-born hackers." Vittoria shook her head. "I can open oysters, that's about it." Langdon took a deep breath and turned to face the eerie collection of diaphanous vaults. He walked to the nearest one and squinted into the dim interior. Inside the glass were amorphous shapes Langdon recognized as the usual bookshelves, parchment bins, and examination tables. He looked up at the indicator tabs glowing at the end of each stack. As in all libraries, the tabs indicated the contents of that row. He read the headlines as he moved down the transparent barrier. "Pietro l'Eremita, Le Crociate, Urbano II, Levant." "They're labeled," he said, still walking, "but it's not Alpha Author." He wasn't surprised. Ancient archives were almost never catalogued alphabetically because so many of the authors were unknown. Titles didn't work either because many historical documents were untitled letters or parchment fragments. Most cataloging was done chronologically. Disconcertingly, however, this arrangement did not appear to be chronological. Langdon felt precious time already slipping away. "Looks like the Vatican has its own system." What a surprise. He examined the labels again. The document spanned centuries, but all the key words, he realized, were interrelated. "I think it's a thematic classification." "Thematic?" Vittoria said, sounding like a disapproving scientist. "Sounds inefficient." "Actually," Langdon thought, considering it more closely, "this may be the shrewdest cataloging I've ever seen." He had always urged his students to understand the overall tones and motifs of an artistic period, rather than getting lost in the minutiae of dates and specific works. The Vatican archives, it seemed, were catalogued on a similar philosophy. Broad strokes. "Everything in this vault," Langdon said, feeling more confident now, centuries of material has to do with the Crusades. That's this vault's theme. It was all here, he realized. Historical accounts, letters, artwork, socio-political data, modern analyses, all in one place, encouraging a deeper understanding of a topic. Brilliant. Victoria frowned. But data can relate to multiple themes simultaneously. Which is why they cross-reference with proxy markers. Langdon pointed through the glass to the colorful plastic tabs inserted among the documents. Those indicate secondary documents located elsewhere with their primary themes. Sure, she said, apparently letting it go. She put her hands on her hips and surveyed the enormous space. Then she looked at Langdon. So, Professor, what's the name of this Galileo thing we're looking for? Langdon couldn't help but smile. He still couldn't fathom that he was standing in this room. It's in here, he thought, somewhere in the dark. It's waiting. Follow me, Langdon said. He started briskly down the first aisle, examining the indicator tabs of each vault. Remember how I told you about the path of illumination? How the Illuminati recruited new members using an elaborate test? The treasure hunt, Victoria said, following closely. The challenge the Illuminati had was that after they placed the markers, they needed some way to tell the scientific community the path existed. Logical, Victoria said. Otherwise nobody would know to look for it. Yes. And even if they knew the path existed, scientists would have no way of knowing where the path began. Rome is huge. Okay. Langdon proceeded down the next aisle, scanning the tabs as he talked. About 15 years ago, some historians at the Sorbonne and I uncovered a series of Illuminati letters filled with references to the segno. The sign. The announcement about the path and where it began. Yes. And since then, plenty of Illuminati academics, myself included, have uncovered other references to the segno. It is accepted theory now that the clue exists, and that Galileo mass distributed it to the scientific community without the Vatican ever knowing. How? We're not sure, but most likely printed publications. He published many books and newsletters over the years. That the Vatican no doubt saw sounds dangerous. True. Nonetheless, the segno was distributed. But nobody has ever actually found it? No. Oddly enough, wherever allusions to the segno appear, Masonic diaries, ancient scientific journals, Illuminati letters, it is often referred to by a number. 666? Langdon smiled. Actually, it's 503. Meaning? None of us could ever figure it out. I became fascinated with 503, trying everything to find meaning in the number. Numerology, map references, latitudes. Langdon reached the end of the aisle, turned the corner, and hurried to scan the next row of tabs as he spoke. For many years, the only clue seemed to be that 503 began with the number 5, one of the sacred Illuminati digits. He paused. Something tells me you recently figured it out, and that's why we're here. Correct, Langdon said, allowing himself a rare moment of pride in his work. Are you familiar with the book by Galileo called Dialogo? Of course. Famous among scientists as the ultimate scientific sellout. Sellout wasn't quite the word Langdon would have used, but he knew what Victoria meant. In the early 1630s, Galileo had wanted to publish a book endorsing the Copernican heliocentric model of the solar system. But the Vatican wouldn't permit the book's release unless Galileo included equally persuasive evidence for the Church's geocentric model, a model Galileo knew to be dead wrong. Galileo had no choice but to acquiesce to the Church's demands and publish a book giving equal time to both the accurate and inaccurate models. As you probably know, Langdon said, despite Galileo's compromise, Dialogo was seen as heretical, and the Vatican placed him under house arrest. No good deed goes unpunished. Langdon smiled. So true. And yet Galileo was persistent.
While under house arrest, he secretly wrote a lesser-known manuscript that scholars often confuse with Dialogo. That book is called Discorsi. Vittoria nodded. I've heard of it. Discourses on the Tides. Langdon stopped short, amazed she had heard of the obscure publication about planetary motion and its effect on the tides. Hey, she said, you're talking to an Italian marine physicist whose father worshipped Galileo. Langdon laughed. Discorsi, however, was not what they were looking for. Langdon explained that Discorsi had not been Galileo's only work while under house arrest. Historians believed he had also written an obscure booklet called Diagramma. Diagramma della verità, Langdon said. Diagram of truth. Never heard of it. I'm not surprised. Diagramma was Galileo's most secretive work. Supposedly some sort of treatise on scientific facts he held to be true but was not allowed to share. Like some of Galileo's previous manuscripts, Diagramma was smuggled out of Rome by a friend and quietly published in Holland. The booklet became wildly popular in the European scientific underground. Then the Vatican caught wind of it and went on a book-burning campaign. Vittoria now looked intrigued. And you think Diagramma contained the clue, the segno, the information about the path of illumination? Diagramma is how Galileo got the word out. That I'm sure of. Langdon entered the third row of vaults and continued surveying the indicator tabs. Archivists have been looking for a copy of Diagramma for years, but between the Vatican burnings and the booklet's low permanence rating, the booklet has disappeared off the face of the earth. Permanence rating? Durability. Archivists rate documents 1 through 10 for their structural integrity. Diagramma was printed on sedge papyrus. It's like tissue paper. Lifespan of no more than a century. Why not something stronger? Galileo's behest, to protect his followers. This way any scientists caught with a copy could simply drop it in water and the booklet would dissolve. It was great for destruction of evidence, but terrible for archivists. It is believed that only one copy of Diagramma survived beyond the 18th century. One? Vittoria looked momentarily starstruck as she glanced around the room. And it's here? Confiscated from the Netherlands by the Vatican shortly after Galileo's death. I've been petitioning to see it for years now, ever since I realized what was in it. As if reading Langdon's mind, Vittoria moved across the aisle and began scanning the adjacent bay of vaults, doubling their pace. Thanks, he said. Look for reference tabs that have anything to do with Galileo, science, scientists. You'll know it when you see it. Okay, but you still haven't told me how you figured out Diagramma contained the clue. It had something to do with the number you kept seeing in Illuminati letters. 503. Langdon smiled. Yes, it took some time, but I finally figured out that 503 is a simple code. It clearly points to Diagramma. For an instant, Langdon relived his moment of unexpected revelation. August 16, 2 years ago. He was standing lakeside at the wedding of the son of a colleague. Bagpipes droned on the water as the wedding party made their unique entrance, across the lake on a barge. The craft was festooned with flowers and wreaths. It carried a Roman numeral painted proudly on the hull, DCII. Puzzled by the marking, Langdon asked the father of the bride, "What's with 602? 602? Langdon pointed at the barge. DCII is the Roman numeral for 602. The man laughed. That's not a Roman numeral. That's the name of the barge. The DCII? The man nodded. The Dick and Connie, too. Langdon felt sheepish. Dick and Connie were the wedding couple. The barge obviously had been named in their honor. What happened to the DC-1? The man groaned. It sank yesterday during the rehearsal luncheon. Langdon laughed. Sorry to hear that. He looked back out of the barge. The DC-2, he thought, like a miniature QE-2. A second later, it had hit him. Now Langdon turned to Vittoria. 503, he said, as I mentioned, is a code.
It's an Illuminati trick for concealing what was actually intended as a Roman numeral. The number 503 in Roman numerals is D-I-I-I. Langdon glanced up. That was fast. Please don't tell me you're an Illuminata. She laughed. I use Roman numerals to codify pelagic strata. Of course, Langdon thought. Don't we all? Vittoria looked over. So what is the meaning of D-I-I-I? D-I and D-I-I and D-I-I-I are very old abbreviations. They were used by ancient scientists to distinguish between the three Galilean documents most commonly confused. Vittoria drew a quick breath.
Dialogo, discorsi, diagramma?
D-1, D-2, D-3. All scientific, all controversial. 503 is D-I-I-I. Diagramma, the third of his books. Vittoria looked troubled. But one thing still doesn't make sense. If this segno, this clue, this advertisement about the path of illumination was really in Galileo's diagramma, why didn't the Vatican see it when they repossessed all the copies? They may have seen it and not noticed. Remember the Illuminati markers? Hiding things in plain view? Dissimulation? The segno apparently was hidden the same way, in plain view, invisible to those who weren't looking for it, and also invisible to those who didn't understand it. Meaning? Meaning Galileo hid it well. According to historic record, the segno was revealed in a mode the Illuminati called lingua pura. The pure language? Yes. Mathematics? That's my guess. Seems pretty obvious. Galileo was a scientist, after all, and he was writing for scientists. Math would be a logical language in which to lay out the clue. The booklet is called Diagramma, so mathematical diagrams may also be part of the code. Vittoria sounded only slightly more hopeful. I suppose Galileo could have created some sort of mathematical code that went unnoticed by the clergy. You don't sound sold, Langdon said, moving down the row. I'm not, mainly because you aren't. If you were so sure about D-I-I-I, why didn't you publish? Then someone who did have access to the Vatican archives could have come in here and checked out Diagramma a long time ago. I didn't want to publish, Langdon said. I had worked hard to find the information and... He stopped himself, embarrassed. You wanted the glory. Langdon felt himself flush. In a manner of speaking. It's just that... Don't look so embarrassed. You're talking to a scientist. Publish or perish. At CERN, we call it substantiate or suffocate. It wasn't only wanting to be the first. I was also concerned that if the wrong people found out about the information in Diagramma, it might disappear. The wrong people being the Vatican? Not that they were wrong, per se, but the Church has always downplayed the Illuminati threat. In the early 1900s, the Vatican went so far as to say the Illuminati were a figment of overactive imaginations. The clergy felt, and perhaps rightly so, that the last thing Christians needed to know was that there was a very powerful anti-Christian movement infiltrating their banks, politics, and universities. Present tense, Robert, he reminded himself. There is a powerful anti-Christian force infiltrating their banks, politics, and universities. So you think the Vatican would have buried any evidence corroborating the Illuminati threat? Quite possibly. Any threat, real or imagined, weakens faith in the Church's power. One more question. Vittoria stopped short and looked at him like he was an alien. Are you serious? Langdon stopped. What do you mean? I mean, is this really your plan to save the day? Langdon wasn't sure whether he saw amused pity or sheer terror in her eyes. You mean finding the Diagramma? No, I mean finding Diagramma, locating a 400-year-old segno, deciphering some mathematical code, and following an ancient trail of art that only the most brilliant scientists in history have ever been able to follow, all in the next 4 hours. Langdon shrugged. I'm open to other suggestions. Chapter 50. Robert Langdon stood outside Archive Vault 9 and read the labels on the stacks. Brahe, Clavius, Copernicus, Kepler, Newton. As he read the names again, he felt a sudden uneasiness. Here are the scientists, but where is Galileo? He turned to Vittoria, who was checking the contents of a nearby vault. I found the right theme, but Galileo's missing. No, he isn't, she said, frowning as she motioned to the next vault. He's over here. But I hope you brought your reading glasses, because this entire vault is his. Langdon ran over. Vittoria was right. Every indicator tab in Vault 10 carried the same keyword. Il processo Galileano. Langdon let out a low whistle, now realizing why Galileo had his own vault. The Galileo affair, he marveled, peering through the glass at the dark outlines of the stacks. The longest and most expensive legal proceeding in Vatican history. 14 years and 600 million lira. It's all here. Have a few legal documents. I guess lawyers haven't involved much over the centuries. Neither have sharks. Langdon strode to a large yellow button on the side of the vault. He pressed it, and a bank of overhead lights hummed on inside. The lights were deep red, turning the cube into a glowing crimson cell, a maze of towering shelves. My God, Vittoria said, looking spooked. Are we tanning or working? Parchment and vellum fades, so vault lighting is always done with dark lights. You could go mad in here. Or worse, Langdon thought, moving toward the vault's sole entrance. A quick word of warning. Oxygen is an oxidant, so hermetic vaults contain very little of it. It's a partial vacuum inside. Your breathing will feel strained. Hey, if old cardinals can survive it. True, Langdon thought. May we be as lucky. The vault entrance was a single electronic revolving door. Langdon noted the common arrangement of 4 access buttons on the door's inner shaft, 1 accessible from each compartment. When a button was pressed, the motorized door would kick into gear and make the conventional half-rotation before grinding to a halt, a standard procedure to preserve the integrity of the inner atmosphere. After I'm in, Langdon said, just press the button and follow me through. There's only 8% humidity inside, so be prepared to feel some dry mouth. Langdon stepped into the rotating compartment and pressed the button. The door buzzed loudly and began to rotate. As he followed its motion, Langdon prepared his body for the physical shock that always accompanied the first few seconds in a hermetic vault. Entering a sealed archive was like going from sea level to 20,000 feet in an instant. Nausea and lightheadedness were not uncommon. Double vision, double over, he reminded himself, quoting the archivist mantra. Langdon felt his ears pop. There was a hiss of air, and the door spun to a stop. He was in. Langdon's first realization was that the air inside was thinner than he had anticipated. The Vatican, it seemed, took their archives a bit more seriously than most. Langdon fought the gag reflex and relaxed his chest while his pulmonary capillaries dilated. The tightness passed quickly. Enter the dolphin, he mused. Gratified, his 50 laps a day were good for something. Breathing more normally now, he looked around the vault. Despite the transparent outer walls, he felt a familiar anxiety. I'm in a box, he thought, a blood-red box. The door buzzed behind him, and Langdon turned to watch Vittoria enter. When she arrived inside, her eyes immediately began watering, and she started breathing heavily. Give it a minute, Langdon said. If you get lightheaded, bend over. I feel, Vittoria choked, like I'm scuba diving with the wrong mixture. Langdon waited for her to acclimatize. He knew she'd be fine. Vittoria Vetra was obviously in terrific shape. Nothing like the doddering ancient Radcliffe alumni Langdon had once squired through Widener Library's hermetic vault. The tour had ended with Langdon giving mouth-to-mouth to an old woman who'd almost aspirated her false teeth. "Feeling better?" he asked. Vittoria nodded. I rode your damn space plane, so I thought I owed you. This brought a smile.
Touché.
Langdon reached into the box beside the door and extracted some white cotton gloves.
Formal affair? Vittoria asked.
Finger acid. We can't handle the documents without them. You'll need a pair. Vittoria donned some gloves.
How long do we have?
Langdon checked his Mickey Mouse watch.
It's just past 7. We have to find this thing within the hour.
Actually, Langdon said, we don't have that kind of time. He pointed overhead to a filtered duct. Normally the curator would turn on a reoxygenation system when someone is inside the vault. Not today. 20 minutes, we'll both be sucking wind. Vittoria blanched noticeably in the reddish glow. Langdon smiled and smoothed his gloves.
Substantiate or suffocate, Miss Vetra. Mickey's ticking.
Chapter 51. BBC reporter Gunther Glick stared at the cell phone in his hand for 10 seconds before he finally hung up. Chinita Macri studied him from the back of the van.
What happened? Who was that?
Glick turned, feeling like a child who had just received a Christmas gift he feared was not really for him.
I just got a tip. Something's going on inside the Vatican.
It's called conclave, Chinita said.
Hell of a tip. No, something else.
Something big. He wondered if the story the caller had just told him could possibly be true. Glick felt ashamed when he realized he was praying it was.
What if I told you 4 cardinals have been kidnapped and are going to be murdered at different churches tonight?
I'd say you're being hazed by someone at the office with a sick sense of humor.
What if I told you we were going to be given the exact location of the first murder?
I'd want to know who the hell you just talked to.
He didn't say.
Perhaps because he's full of shit? Glick had come to expect Macri's cynicism. But what she was forgetting was that liars and lunatics had been Glick's business for almost a decade at the British Tatler. This caller had been neither. This man had been coldly sane. Logical.
I will call you just before 8, the man had said, and tell you where the first killing will occur. The images you record will make you famous.
When Glick had demanded why the caller was giving him this information, the answer had been as icy as the man's Mideastern accent.
The media is the right arm of anarchy.
He told me something else, too, Glick said.
What? That Elvis Presley was just elected Pope?
Dial into the BBC database, will you?
Glick's adrenaline was pumping now.
I want to see what other stories we've run on these guys.
What guys?
Indulge me.
Macri sighed and pulled up the connection to the BBC database.
This'll take a minute.
Glick's mind was swimming.
The caller was very intent to know if I had a cameraman.
Videographer.
And if we could transmit live.
1.537 megahertz.
What is this about?
The database beeped.
Okay, we're in. Who is it you're looking for?
Glick gave her the keyword. Macri turned and stared.
I sure as hell hope you're kidding.
Chapter 52. The internal organization of Archival Vault 10 was not as intuitive as Langdon had hoped, and the Diagramma manuscript did not appear to be located with other similar Galilean publications. Without access to the computerized Biblion and a reference locator, Langdon and Vittoria were stuck.
You're sure the Diagramma is in here? Vittoria asked.
Positive. It's a confirmed listing in both the Ufficio della Propaganda delle Fede.
Fine, as long as you're sure.
She headed left while he went right. Langdon began his manual search. He needed every bit of self-restraint not to stop and read every treasure he passed. The collection was staggering. The Assayer, the Starry Messenger, the Sunspot Letters, Letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, Apologia pro Galileo, on and on. It was Vittoria who finally struck gold near the back of the vault. Her throaty voice called out,
Diagramma della Verita.
Langdon dashed through the crimson haze to join her.
Where?
Vittoria pointed, and Langdon immediately realized why they had not found it earlier. The manuscript was in a folio bin, not on the shelves. Folio bins were a common means of storing unbound pages. The label on the front of the container left no doubt about the contents.
Diagramma della Verita.
Galileo Galilei, 1639. Langdon dropped to his knees, his heart pounding.
Diagramma.
He gave her a grin.
Nice work. Help me pull out this bin.
Vittoria knelt beside him, and they heaved. The metal tray on which the bin was sitting rolled toward them on casters, revealing the top of the container.
No lock?
Vittoria said, sounding surprised at the simple latch.
Never. Documents sometimes need to be evacuated quickly. Floods and fires.
So, open it.
Langdon didn't need any encouragement. With his academic life's dream right in front of him, and the thinning air in the chamber, he was in no mood to dawdle. He unsnapped the latch and lifted the lid. Inside, flat on the floor of the bin, lay a black duck-cloth pouch. The cloth's breathability was critical to the preservation of its contents. Reaching in with both hands and keeping the pouch horizontal, Langdon lifted it out of the bin.
I expected a treasure chest, Vittoria said. Looks more like a pillowcase.
Follow me, he said. Holding the bag before him like a sacred offering, Langdon walked to the center of the vault where he found the customary glass-topped archival exam table. Although the central location was intended to minimize in-vault travel of documents, researchers appreciated the privacy the surrounding stacks afforded. Career-making discoveries were uncovered in the top vaults of the world, and most academics didn't like rivals peering through the glass as they worked. Langdon laid the pouch on the table and unbuttoned the opening. Vittoria stood by. Rummaging through a tray of archivist tools, Langdon found the felt pad pincers archivists called finger symbols, oversized tweezers with flattened discs on each arm. As his excitement mounted, Langdon feared at any moment he might awake back in Cambridge with a pile of test papers to grade. Inhaling deeply, he opened the bag. Fingers trembling in their cotton gloves, he reached in with his tongs.
Relax, Vittoria said. It's paper, not plutonium.
Langdon slid the tongs around the stack of documents inside and was careful to apply even pressure. Then, rather than pulling out the documents, he held them in place while he slid off the bag, an archivist's procedure for minimizing torque on the artifact. Not until the bag was removed and Langdon had turned on the exam dark light beneath the table did he begin breathing again. Vittoria looked like a specter now, lit from below by the lamp beneath the glass.
Small sheets, she said, her voice reverent.
Langdon nodded. The stack of folios before them looked like loose pages from a small paperback novel. Langdon could see that the top sheet was an ornate pen and ink cover sheet, with the title, the date, and Galileo's name in his own hand. In that instant, Langdon forgot the cramped quarters, forgot his exhaustion, forgot the horrifying situation that had brought him here. He simply stared in wonder. Close encounters with history always left Langdon numbed with reverence, like seeing the brushstrokes on the Mona Lisa. The muted yellow papyrus left no doubt in Langdon's mind as to its age and authenticity. But excluding the inevitable fading, the document was in superb condition. Slight bleaching of the pigment, minor sundering and cohesion of the papyrus, but all in all in damn fine condition. He studied the ornate hand-etching of the cover, his vision blurred by the lack of humidity. Vittoria was silent.
Hand me a spatula, please.
Langdon motioned beside Vittoria to a tray filled with stainless steel archival tools. She handed it to him. Langdon took the tool in his hand. It was a good one. He ran his fingers across the face to remove any static charge, and then, ever so carefully, slid the blade beneath the cover. Then, lifting the spatula, he turned over the cover sheet. The first page was written in longhand, the tiny, stylized calligraphy almost impossible to read. Langdon immediately noticed that there were no diagrams or numbers on the page. It was an essay.
"Heliocentricity,"
Vittoria said, translating the heading on Folio 1. She scanned the text. "Looks like Galileo renouncing the geocentric model once and for all. Ancient Italian, though, so no promises on the translation."
"Forget it," Langdon said. "We're looking for math, the pure language."
He used the spatula tool to flip the next page. Another essay. No math or diagrams. Langdon's hands began to sweat inside his gloves.
"Movement of the planets," Vittoria said, translating the title.
Langdon frowned. On any other day, he would have been fascinated to read it. Incredibly, NASA's current model of planetary orbits, observed through high-powered telescopes, was supposedly almost identical to Galileo's original predictions.
"No math," Vittoria said. "He's talking about retrograde motions and elliptical orbits or something."
Elliptical orbits? Langdon recalled that much of Galileo's legal trouble had begun when he described planetary motion as elliptical. The Vatican exalted the perfection of the circle and insisted heavenly motion must be only circular. Galileo's Illuminati, however, saw perfection in the ellipse as well, revering the mathematical duality of its twin foci. The Illuminati's ellipse was prominent even today in modern Masonic tracing boards and footing inlays.
"Next," Vittoria said.
Langdon flipped.
"Lunar phases and tidal motion," she said. "No numbers, no diagrams."
Langdon flipped again.
"Nothing."
He kept flipping through a dozen or so pages.
"Nothing, nothing, nothing." "I thought this guy was a mathematician," Vittoria said. "This is all text."
Langdon felt the air in his lungs begin to thin. His hopes were thinning, too. The pile was waning.
"Nothing here," Vittoria said. "No math. A few dates, a few standard figures, but nothing that looks like it could be a clue."
Langdon flipped over the last folio and sighed. It, too, was an essay.
"Short book,"
Vittoria said, frowning.
Langdon nodded. "Merda, as we say in Rome."
"Shit is right," Langdon thought. His reflection in the glass seemed mocking, like the image staring back at him this morning from his bay window, an aging ghost.
"There's got to be something," he said, the hoarse desperation in his voice surprising him. "The Senyo is here somewhere. I know it." "Maybe you were wrong about D-I-I-I.
Langdon turned and stared at her.
"Okay," she agreed. "D-I-I-I makes perfect sense, but maybe the clue isn't mathematical."
"Lingua pura. What else would it be?"
"Art?"
"Except there are no diagrams or pictures in the book."
"All I know is that lingua pura refers to something other than Italian. Math just seems logical."
"I agree." Langdon refused to accept defeat so quickly. "The numbers must be written longhand. The math must be in words rather than equations.
It'll take some time to read all the pages."
"Time's something we don't have. We'll have to split the work." Langdon flipped the stack back over to the beginning.
"I know enough Italian to spot numbers."
Using his spatula, he cut the stack like a deck of cards and laid the first half-dozen pages in front of Vittoria.
"It's in here somewhere, I'm sure."
Vittoria reached down and flipped her first page by hand.
"Spatula,"
Langdon said, grabbing her an extra tool from the tray.
"Use the spatula."
"I'm wearing gloves," she grumbled. "How much damage could I cause?"
"Just use it."
Vittoria picked up the spatula.
"You feeling what I'm feeling?"
"Tense?"
"No, short of breath."
Langdon was definitely starting to feel it, too. The air was thinning faster than he had imagined. He knew they had to hurry. Archival conundrums were nothing new for him, but usually he had more than a few minutes to work them out. Without another word, Langdon bowed his head and began translating the first page in his stack.
"Show yourself, damn it! Show yourself!"
Chapter 53.
Somewhere beneath Rome, the dark figure prowled down a stone ramp into the underground tunnel. The ancient passageway was lit only by torches, making the air hot and thick. Up ahead, the frightened